I love this film, and it's a little glimpse into an alternate dimension where George Lucas didn't have the huge Star Wars success and instead was more of a smaller independent, maybe even art filmmaker.
I really enjoyed it. I think the soundtrack is phenomenal. It's like it's from a different director. Like, you could wipe that title card at the start, and I could have been the biggest Star Wars fan ever. I've watched this film, and I would have never have guessed that this was from the same guy. It's so, so good, and it is just so different. It's so inventive, and it feels so exciting to watch another universe that might have been.
Hello, film fans. Joining Flix Watch today, we have Michael.
Hello.
Jake.
Hiya.
And as always, Kobe.
Yep.
And we are here to review American Graffiti.
Thank you, as always, to the Mighty People for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher.
Hello, film fans. Welcome to Flix Watch Podcast. Joining us remotely today, we have Michael and Jake. If you could please say hello to the listeners and tell them a little bit more about who you are, please.
Sure. I'm Jake. I'm a podcast host and producer on the show Ghibliotech, which is a show, surprisingly, all about the films of Studio Ghibli, although we're now branching out into lots of other stuff as well. And I'm the co-author of the book Ghibliotech, an unofficial guide to the movies of Studio Ghibli, which I was lucky enough to write with this man.
Yes, I wrote about 50% of that book, sharing the credits, although I'm credited first. That was something that I stipulated. Age before beauty.
Yeah, have you done a word count? Have you done a word count to see who wrote more?
I just don't want to embarrass Jake by doing a word count. I say I found it harder to fit to my word limit per chapter.
Yeah, it's about quality, not quantity, isn't it, Michael? Come on,
that's
mate.
What you say. Yes, it's been really fun doing the podcast over the years, bringing Jake up to speed, turning him from the Padawan into the Jedi Master of Studio Ghibli, and now writing this book, which I suppose there are books about Studio Ghibli out there, some amazing ones, but perhaps not many that are pitched more towards just film fans and beginners. Sort of what we do is we have chapter by chapter, film by film, a bit of historical background, and then Jake's sort of expert film fan review. So that's our sort of Bible for turning more people into diehard Ghibli fans.
And it's Ghibli is like amazing. And I've not watched anywhere near as many as I should do. And that's shocking, especially as it is freely available now on Netflix. But it still seems to be there seems to be a roadblock for some people for Ghibli. And I don't understand why that is necessarily. There's people, myself and Helena, maybe I wouldn't say people as one person. We know it doesn't like animation full stop, which still makes me sometimes shakes me awake when I'm in deep sleep. Sometimes I think there's people that don't like animation full stop. And I've had friends who say they don't like the way Ghibli looks. But for me, I think it looks, every single film I think looks amazing. I just haven't got around to watching it. So maybe there's a step of the people who, there's more of me that needs to get around to watching more Ghibli films. How do we get people to watch more Ghibli films? I suspect it's read your book and listen to your podcast.
Well, I mean, so the book is chronological through all of their films, but the podcast, if you go to that, that was not in chronological order. That was curated in a way by Michael to help get me into the studio. So if you actually go back to the start of the podcast, and the episode one is Spirited Away, so like a big hitter, it's the one that won the Oscar, followed by My Neighbor Totoro, which is another big classic, well-beloved. You've seen him cameo in Toy Story 3. And so like that, and that's just our first six episodes kind of covering some of the really key text as well as some cult favorites. So I think, yeah, take the podcast journey. That's what got me into it. So I said that Michael built a good syllabus, and I'd recommend other people follow it.
Yeah, and not to sort of undersell what we do, the great thing about Studio Ghibli compared to, say, any other filmography you look at, so we're going to be talking about George Lucas shortly. He's a guy who, you know, half his films maybe aren't up to scratch, but
half?
three quarters, almost the entire output of Lucasfilm. Just avoid it, anything with him as producer that's not called Indiana Jones. But with Studio Ghibli, they really made 12 five-star films, and maybe not 12. Let's say 10, four and a half five-star films.
I can check how many you logged as five.
So Jake is now referring to Letterboxd. But that's the thing. I think that they have a run from the mid-late 80s all the way up to the mid-2000s, and they have two filmmakers who are both firing on all cylinders, working at the top of their game, doing very different things, but, you know, working in concert with one another. So I think that compared to many other filmographies, really picking any film that catches your eye, apart from the one or two that we'd recommend you dodged, you couldn't go wrong, really.
And a lot of them are fairly short as well. It's like My Neighbor Totoro, one of the best films ever made, less than 90 minutes. Go check it out.
There's another podcast for that. There's four main cartoon studio animation studios, I say, that's kind of vying for our attention at the moment. I'm not going to include Disney on that. More auteur ones. You have Sony Animations, DreamWorks, Pixar, and Cartoon Saloon. Which one of those are you most excited about the next film from?
Probably the one that we did a podcast series on.
Cartoon Saloon.
We went through all of their feature works, and they haven't made a bad film. They have made some superb films. They maybe made the best film of last year with Wolfwalkers. I'm so excited to see what they do next. I think they're such an exciting presence. And they get kind of thrown this moniker of like the new Ghibli or Ireland's Miyazaki, referring to the director Tom Moore. And they're very distinct, and they've got their own look. But if anyone was to kind of carry that mantle, then I'd be happy for it to be them.
Yep, I would not disagree with that. They're also a studio, unlike Ghibli. So Ghibli, when they formed, we're only going to do features. We're not going to sell out and do TV series. But Cartoon Saloon do really good TV series as well. I know, Kobe, you've got a little one. I don't know if you've been exposed to the wonders of Puffin Rock yet. That's on Netflix. It's just wonderful. I mean, that's very Ghibli-ish as well, because it's about Puffin siblings having very low stakes adventures on an island off the coast of Ireland, and it's just absolutely lovely.
I look forward to it. I look forward to that. We're on Gigantosaurus if we do anything on Netflix with him. But anyway, we're here to talk about different films. Cartoon Saloon, magnificent. For me, it's a toss-up between them and Sony, because they've only had two films and they've both been the best. But Cartoon Saloon have had four films and they've been the best also. I think Breadwinner is genuinely one of the best films I've ever seen. And for an Irish company to do a film based out in an Arabic-speaking world, based off of those kind of settings, I think is perhaps more astounding than Wolfwalkers, to be honest with you, the way they did that. But Helen, sorry, have you got any thoughts? Pixar, Sony Animations?
I'm probably not so hot on animations as you are. I haven't seen any of the Cartoon Saloon animations. I've kind of like missed them. And so after Kevin...
Kevin did Grubbers. It was
did Will Collins?
Did Will do it?
Yeah.
Will that's Collins. It, yeah.
Yeah.
I had a look and their films aren't available to stream. I couldn't find them to stream.
Well, I know you're called Flix Watcher. I don't know if you ever entertain other streaming services, but I think Song of the Sea and maybe the Breadwinner's gone off it now, but they were both on Prime Video at some point. And Wolfwalkers is Apple TV Plus. And actually, their next feature is for Netflix. So it'll all be on your radar eventually. But I know what you mean. Their first film, The Secret of Kells, is one of those you have to go and actually buy a physical copy of. I don't think that's actually available to stream or rent.
Yeah, which is a shame, because I would like to rectify this, but I haven't come across them quite as easily as I was probably expecting. With you just kind of expect to, between like the five subscriptions I've probably got going on, that they're there and it's like suddenly not available.
As far as I'm a bit on Mubi.
Yeah, kind of feels a bit Mubi-y, but yeah, we'll see.
Anyway, we digress. Get Bibliotheque the book. It's out now, guys. And now we're going to talk about American Graffiti, which is Michael's choice. Michael, tell us why you chose it and then give us a synopsis in a minute or less.
Gosh, why did I choose it? So I grew up a very strong Star Wars kid. My life was very much defined by Star Wars up until the age of 12, 13, where The Phantom Menace ruined everything. And when I discovered, I mean, it's not a great discovery, it was a popular film, but when I discovered American Graffiti at uni, suddenly I realized, oh wait, George Lucas at one point was a great filmmaker and he just lost his way for many, many decades. So that's one reason why I love this film. I think it's a great new Hollywood film and it's a little glimpse into an alternate dimension where George Lucas didn't have the huge Star Wars success and instead was more of a smaller independent, maybe even art filmmaker.
And can you tell us the synopsis starting now?
Well, there's a short or a long synopsis, so I'll do the middle length one. This is one night in late summer in Modesto, California, small town California, following the evening and early morning into the next day with various intersecting storylines with a bunch of characters focusing on two, played by Ron Howard and Richard Dreyfuss, who are about to fly out that morning to start college.
Fair play. Jake, overall thoughts on American Graffiti?
I think American Graffiti is fantastic. What a pleasure to watch this. What a great choice by Michael. I really enjoyed it. I think the soundtrack is phenomenal and it's something that I've been enjoying listening to in my own time in the days since watching this. And I think, yeah, as Michael says, it's like it's from a different director. Like if you could wipe that title card at the start and I could have been the biggest Star Wars fan ever, I've watched this film and I would have never have guessed that this was from the same guy. As a piece of history, it's fascinating. But as a piece of filmmaking, it's so, so good. And it is just so different. It's so inventive. And it feels so exciting to watch another universe that might have been.
Far, far, long time. I can't be bothered to do the call. cannot be bothered. Helen.
So I think I may have watched this before, but a very, 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 very long time ago.
In a galaxy far, far away.
Sorry.
I struggle a little bit with this film, and I don't think it's this film in particular, but I think it's this type of film in that I find it difficult to connect with a nostalgia that I never experienced. And I think that's what it is for me. There's moments in it where you can kind of see sort of his love of wanting to create innovative film, but on the level where I don't connect with the characters and I don't have a kind of like a feeling to that particular time that it's being nostalgic about, I don't get that. And I think because I love reading Letterboxd reviews, and quite a lot of the Letterboxd reviews sort of talk about this and its similarities to Dazed and Confused, which is another film I've watched recently and not connected with. So I think for the kind of same reasons. So I don't think it's a fault of this film. I think it's something that difficult for me to kind of have feelings for something that I don't feel nostalgic for, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. If it doesn't connect with you, I mean, like Lady Bird, for example, is a film. I get why it's good, but it wasn't for me. I love Greta Gerwig. I love everything about the setup about it. But just when I watched it, I was like, God damn it. Just didn't hit me in the way I wanted it to. So I get that with things. And I'd still recommend Lady Bird, obviously, because it has moved so many people. And I love Greta Gerwig to bits, like I say, and all these other pieces. For me, this is, I wanted to love it, but I just couldn't. And I think there was the piece. I think unrelatable characters started to get my craw a bit. And unlike Helen Knight, Days Confused is one of my favourite films. But I think I caught that at the right time. I first watched that when I was just about to go to university and me and my friends just had all these super long nights just hanging out and being knobheads. And that kind of tied in. We weren't driving around aimlessly, but, you know, it was still that kind of phase of my life. And I can see, obviously, Richard Linklater has watched American Graffiti and thought, yeah, I want to do that with my people. And so I think it's a bit more punchy. I think a few things will happen more that are more interesting. But then you also have films like, I like films that are over One Night, like Warriors, even through like Superbad and Booksmart, where there's just a one night where things happen and tell the story. It's that overarching thing. I really think it's a nice storytelling piece there, but I just didn't gel with Richie Cunningham, aka Ron Howard. I thought he was a bit of a dick. I didn't get what Richard Dreyfuss was doing, like saying I'm going to flip flopping between college and not. I quite like the speed drag racing pieces and just kind of cruising around, running a red light and then like hanging out for a bit. I kind of like that hanging out bit. But Richie and Richard Dreyfuss, so I should say Ron and Richard, I kind of left me a bit cold. And I think when you have something like this, you need to be able to hook into the characters. And I couldn't do that.
Gosh, how do I even come back against these now?
Please.
So I agree, Helen. Sometimes I struggle with a nostalgia for a time that I wasn't present in. But I think I'd say what fascinates me about this film is that they're only making this film 10 years after the fact. And already you could tell how much the world had changed between 62, 63 and 72, 73. Even with our sort of scant knowledge of pop culture history, this is just before Beatlemania happens, just before The Graduate changes what American teenagers are. But also, when rewatching it this time, what's wild to me is that if it's only 10 years after the fact, could you imagine anyone now trying to make a nostalgia movie for 2012, 2011?
Well, Michael, I've just got up the Billboard Top 10 for 2010, which would be when this film would be set now if we were making it in 2021. And so imagine the soundtrack of TikTok by Kesha, California Girls by Katy Perry, Bad Romance by Lady Gaga and Dynamite by Tayo Cruz would all be appearing on American Graffiti 2021.
But that's also the thing that is so radical about a film like this, is that it was really a risk for them to do that with the soundtrack. This was only shortly after films like The Graduate, where they brought in pop songs on soundtracks to be sold alongside the films. But also, this is music that, you know, they had a sell-by date. Circa 1960s, early 70s, the Beach Boys were Dead in the Water, and this release, along with, you know, Beach Boys and other bands and artists on the soundtrack, had something of a revival. And you wouldn't, you know, if you had Coldplay or Lady Gaga or something, they're still around now. It's a very different sort of thing. But that's getting into sort of the sociological, cultural stuff around this, which is a bit galaxy brain, which I do love about this film. But I suppose if the characters aren't immediately relatable, that's fair. I can't argue against that. But I do like George Lucas's approach to this and the screenwriters, where they do just want this to be something like a documentary. They don't want to push the characters too far in a direction, really. They just wanted them to exist. And there is something quite, I'll say experimental, with the fact that Richard Dreyfuss's character is just there, hands in pockets, just walking around town, just seeing who's there and just having a bit of a chat with them. You reference Richard Linklater in Dazed and Confused. Of course, when that comes out, we've had 20 years of teen movies that have come after American Graffiti, when really the Richard Linklater movie I'd compare American Graffiti with would be his debut film Slacker, which is just this hangout movie where we're just going to go and see some characters in one place and they'll come and say their piece and go off. And that's why this film, you know, with inflation, makes hundreds of millions of dollars across various re-releases. But at the heart of it is something so radical and experimental and structureless.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of how quickly a film will drop out of the cinemas now, like if you don't have a good opening weekend, you could be gone from cinemas in your first week these days. American Graffiti stayed in cinemas for 2 years.
Oh, I can imagine. I can 100% imagine. It's one of those things I completely see how this laid the foundation, was a blueprint for teen movies going on. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely love it for that. And I do like aimless stuff. You know, Richard Linklater wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for this. Because walking around talking about just random shit is something that perhaps didn't happen in films before this. And I love it for that. I love, if we didn't have this, we wouldn't have the Before trilogy.
Exactly,
which I think is one of the pinnacles of walkie-talkie films.
Not to push the whole Easy Riders, Raging Bulls type narrative on this, but the exciting thing about that new Hollywood generation is that they were both a product of the first wave of film school education and awareness of international world cinema, the French New Wave, Akira Kurosawa, Japanese cinema, Ingmar Bergman. But they were also suburban American kids who grew up out of that first wave of suburbia. And George Lucas loses that. I mean, you can see elements of that in Star Wars, how really, you know, Luke Skywalker is just a gearhead kid who just wants to get out of town. But American Graffiti is almost the perfect marriage of these experimental urges taken from French New Wave, the fact that they're shooting it on quite low grade, low budget camera stock, the fact that they have Walter Murch on sound design, who's creating this sound tapestry where it's basically the entire soundtrack of the film as you watch it is one huge radio show punctuated by Wolfman Jack doing the interstitial bits.
You see then Quentin Tarantino using that in Reservoir Dogs.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you could, like, the cars in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the car sequences and that owe themselves to this. And the use of the radio. Also,
Warriors having that radio DJ over...
And when he was pitching it, he was saying, like, it's a musical but without songs.
That's a great way of putting it. So he has these, you know, very experimental ideas, radical ideas, but he wants to marry it to something very everyday, very real, very human of these characters and their sort of low stakes life, where really the most, I guess, there are two spectacular moments in this where the police car gets its tires pulled off, and then there's the actual drag race at the end, which doesn't, I mean, that the car gets flipped, but it's not really, it's hardly a pod race scene, is it? But so it is almost the perfect new Hollywood thing at the similar time, Steven Spielberg coming around. You could really see this. I always puzzled me growing up when I'd see those pictures of Francis Ford Coppola, Brian De Palma, Martin Scorsese, George Lucas sitting together. I mean, you mean the Ewok guy is hanging out with the Mean Streets guy and the Godfather guy? How does that happen? And then there's the blowout Dressed to Kill guy. So with this, you could see how they're all coming out of the same soup of influences and inspiration.
And those guys obviously then go into shape and make sure that Star Wars isn't a complete disaster.
Well, Easy Rider's Raging Bulls is a fascinating book, and Peter Biskind sort of puts a bit too much of his own reading on the characters of behind the book and psychologies of them. But it's always stuck with me how he said that George Lucas was somebody who loved working with people. And that's in this film. Haskell Wexler coming in, helping with cinematography. You've got to cut the profits. Marcia Lucas, his first wife, helping out on editing. He is a collaborator at heart, but what George Lucas does is create Skywalker Ranch and lives in a mansion in the middle of the desert away from everybody else. And that's sort of how he's left at the end of Easy Riders, Raging Bulls in the mid-80s, when he's sitting on his Star Wars millions saying, I really should make a small movie like American Graffiti again. And he never does, which I find so fascinating. But to get back to, like, the film, I can very easily go off on the stories behind the films.
I love it.
About teen movies and the sort of teen movie genre this one kicks off, and it tends to happen in decade cycles. So you have this film in the early 70s, you have Fast Times at Ridgemont High for the 80s, Dazed and Confused for the 90s, and then films like Can't Hardly Wait at the end of the 90s. And they basically introduce you to all the actors you're going to be watching for the next 10, 15, 20 years. And that's what's so great about American Graffiti, where, you know, we think we know Ron Howard now. He's a bit overexposed because of Happy Days and then as a filmmaker. But this is like him, his first adult role. Richard Dreyfuss.
This is Ronnie Howard.
Exactly.
That's yeah. credited.
So, yeah, because I, you know, when I first watched Happy Days, I generally thought it was made in the 50s. So where was this? Where was this in relation to Happy Days?
I mean, Happy Days is riding the coattails of this film. And of course, they hire, okay, it's Cindy Williams and Ron Howard off the back of this film, who are both in it. And they just basically steal the idea of it and take it to television and turn it into not only one long-running TV series, but several spin-offs with that 1950s nostalgia. And I think that's where it definitely gets overplayed and becomes a bit stereotypical and plays into what Helen was saying about nostalgia that we don't care for. But between Ron Howard and Richard Dreyfuss, who's only a couple of years away from Jaws, I do also love seeing Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford, at the time when he was seriously considering quitting acting and just being a carpenter for the rest of his life, was brought into this to play this role, and he said, I'll only play this role if I don't have to cut my hair, which is a weird stipulation to make.
It's kind of interesting seeing him kind of play a very unlikable character, because we obviously grew up with him as Indiana Jones and Han Solo, so to see him kind of starting out like this and be kind of like pretty dark is really interesting, because I think that's sort of what people mostly sort of say about the performances, that, you know, it's his early one and it's one of that, but really it is Richard Dreyfuss, really, and he's just kind of so interesting in this. He's probably the most interesting character for me in this, and I probably could have spent more time with him rather than some of the other characters, but he's just kind of got this weird sort of twitchy energy to him, and he's sort of the one that we get kind of like the, I'm not really sure about the kind of the ending, like the where are they now kind of endings for the fictional characters. It kind of feels a little bit strange, but he's kind of the one you want to, the one I was like, oh, okay, I think that's good that I find out how we ended up, or maybe I would have liked it to have been a mystery. I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure about the ending. Haven't decided.
On that ending, because you've got one character dies in a car crash, one is missing in action in Vietnam, one stays in the town and becomes an accountant, and then Richard Dreyfuss goes to Canada and becomes a writer. And I think Richard Dreyfuss is definitely the one that's like kind of the most humanized and most rounded and has the best adventure. And so you can see George Lucas definitely investing much in him, because George Lucas was the suburbanite who wanted to get out of town. And so when those end cards come up, I'm thinking, so George Lucas is saying, if you don't leave your hometown, you're either going to be boring or dead.
But I think that ending is his attempt to puncture the nostalgia, because he knows what's coming. He knows that in whatever they do, whether they get out of town or not, they're all going to try and get drafted. I guess Richard Dreyfuss dodges the draft by going to Canada. There is a really funny trivia thing about this. So George Lucas is notorious for tinkering with his movies after being released, after they've released.
Is he?
Yeah, exactly. So they've made the sequel to this, more American Graffiti, in 78, later in the decade. And it's kind of seen now as a bit of a cash-in. But what they do is they retell the story of how John Milner dies, and to the point where when they re-released American Graffiti, they had to change the end card for him and change the month of the car crash. This little tweak that George Lucas had to make to make things sync up with the sequel. But I do think that that end card, because there's also a lot out there about how, and this is a flaw of the film, I will level at it. It's not as interesting in the female characters as the male characters, although I do think all of the women are amazing, and they have some of the standout sequences and performances are from the female characters.
And with the end card, I was kind of disappointed there's no female characters in the end card.
I think George Lucas was criticized for that at the time, and he said in interviews that he wanted that end card to be like the punctuation point at the end, and if he had it been two or more, it might have got a bit long. That sounds a bit like a cop-out excuse to me, but
sounds like it's
yeah. But every other film that it follows in its wake does make sure that everyone has their end card moment.
Do you want to say anything else, guys, before we head to the score? Should we do a brief pressy on George Lucas as to whether is he a good filmmaker?
I think if based on this film, yes.
I think we need to see a pattern, though, don't we? Everyone can have their rookie year and smash it out of the park.
Well,
and sophomore effort in Star Wars. But so, if you were to say now a new George Lucas film's coming out next year, how excited would you be to see it?
I'd be so excited. I don't know if I'd be excited about the guarantee of a perfect film, but Christ, I think everyone would be excited for a new George Lucas film, because you don't know, like, maybe in the vein of this, it could well be a big car crash.
Fair play.
I think when I went and rewatched all the Star Wars films a few years ago, the first Star Wars film doesn't tend to, you know, A New Hope, as it's known, but when it was released, it was just Star Wars. People tend to think that was, you know, a good solid film, but Empire Strikes Back is the great one. What I love about Star Wars is the fact that it is a piece of pop art, and it is colliding all these ideas. It's not really trying to create a big mythic world. It's not trying to create a lore or mythos. It's just, what if Kurosawa, Western, Gearhead, Kid, all these things all in one film? And I think that his first three films, THX 1138 and American Graffiti and Star Wars, are the work of a filmmaker who is a great pop artist, who is coming out of film school, but also has this great love of pop culture that he's drawing from. He gets a bit more of that back when he's working with Spielberg on the first Indiana Jones movies, but he's a different filmmaker from Empire Strikes Back on. Once he's becoming the Dreamweaver, he's a different filmmaker.
On just another George Lucas point, I was wondering whether the gear shift in Mandalorian was picked up from American Graffiti.
With Baby Yoda. I was thinking
And I wonder whether that was a conscious thing, looking back on this. Just a little wink to the Lucas fans out there.
can I say one last thing about Harrison Ford, which I looked, as I was watching this time, I was looking him up. So I never realized that Harrison Ford is a couple of years older than George Lucas. That's just how old. We don't think Harrison Ford is, he's like at least 15 years older than you think he is, because he was already 35, I think, by the time Star Wars came out.
Oh, really? Okay, hold on. That's only 7 years younger than me. Oh, yeah.
And he'd already lived like a whole other life and had several careers. But what's crazy to think about it in that way, I know that his character, Falfa, when he turns up, is meant to be an adult. But even if that guy's meant to be in his early 20s, Harrison Ford, even with a 10-year gap between the nostalgia gap, he's still older than all the characters in that film.
Yeah. But we have the... Back in those days, I mean, Greece, for example, those kids there, Stockard Channing was like 30
they
something. playing that. So I think that's just how you did it then, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think Ron Howard was legitimately quite young, and who else? Charles Martin Smith. I think this was one of his first roles. He was still quite young. There is a alternate universe where that's Bob Balaban. I know one of your favorite actors, Jake, or at least a face you like to see in films.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, love a bit of
Balaban turned it down and then regretted it for the rest of his career, he said.
Right. Yeah, well, but then he got to be in Close Encounters, so it all worked out.
Exactly, yeah.
Right, let's head to the scores, guys.
I'm Sam Clements, host of the 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival, another podcast in the Stripped Media family, a podcast that celebrates movies under 90 minutes long. Each episode, I'm joined by a special guest who selects a movie to join our prestigious lineup. Past guests have come from the worlds of film, television, music, food, comedy, and podcasting. Search for us now on the app you're currently listening to this podcast, or join us at 90minfilmfest.com.
Welcome to the Flicks Watcher scores, all of the scores out of 5. You may have decimal places if you wish, and we will start with you, please, Michael, with your recommendability.
Absolutely 5, because I think it has that great hook for a recommendation, which is you may think you know this filmmaker, you may think that, oh, George Lucas, he's the guy that does Star Wars and, the prequels and everything else, but did you know he actually made this film beforehand that was nominated for Best Picture, that got him all sorts of acclaim and changed the face of teenagers on the big screen? I think there's something delicious about that recommendation that's pretty strong. So 5.
Jake?
I'll probably go for a 4, just because I'd want to know who I was recommending this to before I recommended it, whereas I think a 5 is a pretty populist thing where you could kind of just shove it in front of anyone and they're going to go with it. Whereas I think you if you can curate your selection here, I think you need to. But I think it's very good. So yeah, got to be a 4.
Helen?
Yeah, so it's not really a film for me. And there'd be definitely a very, very specific group of people that I'd recommend it to. I don't think it's probably got broadish appeal. But for anyone who's kind of interested in kind of cinema of that era, so, any fans of Scorsese, Coppola, you've kind of got to go to the beginning to see where they started out and get a feel for what they were trying to do when they first laid kind of their hands on a camera. So although it's kind of not really for me, I'm kind of glad I've seen it and a lot of things make sense. So I'm going to give it a 3.8.
A lot of things make sense. I'm going to go for 3.5. As I've said many times here before, recommendability for me is a 5 is I can just say, you've not seen Back to the Future. What the hell are you playing at? Go and see it right now. Stop anything you're doing. I don't know who you are, but you're wrong. But yeah, the more caveats you have to build into it, the more the recommendability goes down. And with this, I love the idea of saying to someone, oh, this is George Lucas's early films. This leads on to this, this, this. But I think we sometimes forget that, you know, us four here and many of the people, a few of the people know, we kind of surround ourselves by other cinephiles and cineasts who are happy to think, I'll happily hunt down George Lucas's early works, because that's the kind of person we are. But for the vast majority of people, that isn't the case. And underlying that is a film, is a story which I think isn't as strong as I'd love it to be. So yeah, 3.5.
This was a massive popular movie in its day. In its day, though, much money. Also, Back to the Future. Come on, Back to the Future is half a riff on American Graffiti. All of its 1950s sequences were definitely indebted to this film. Would not exist without this. In fact, when they were talking about the sequel to American Graffiti, George Lucas wanted Zemeckis to direct it. And Zemeckis said, nope, I'd rather have Marty McFly go back in time and potentially have a romance with his mum.
Ooh, but when you see Robert Zemeckis's I Want to Hold Your Hand, you can totally see why he would want to get him to do American Graffiti, because Want to Hold Your Hand is just like American Graffiti vibes, but the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Repeat the score. Michael?
I'd say 5 because of the very structure of it. There's something that you may pick up differently every time. And for me, there's one element that really hit me this time around, which is the sequence. All the way through, you've been hearing Wolfman Jack on the radio as this sort of mystical figure that's been turning on all the kids to this music, the power of AM radio from the 1950s, how omnipresent it is, but also how powerful the music is in the shaping of their lives, the soundtrack of their lives. And then Richard Dreyfuss, because he's been chasing this character, this white T-bird, the woman in the white T-bird, all the way through. He goes to the station to put out a shout out to her. And there's this beautiful sequence where it's about mystique and the role pop culture plays in our lives, and almost this Wizard of Oz moment, really, the man behind the curtain who is Wolfman Jack. And it's something so poetic, the fact that Richard Dreyfuss gets to see that, where, of course, the guy's there with his melting popsicles and sticky fingers and says, oh, it's not me, you know, the Wolfman. He's this figure who's flying, you know, going around town, going around the world, finding his music. And then you just get that little glimpse of the magic of the guy on the microphone who's different from the guy off mic. And as people who speak into microphones all the time, I think there's something quite powerful about that for us.
Jake?
I think I'm going to go with a 4 on this. This is my second or third time watching the film. And I find it's so rich in detail. I think it's such a woozy film to watch, and you can just get lost in it and you can pick up new things. And because you're not too invested in the plot, and it's more about that atmosphere, you can drift off into the corners of the screen and see what other stuff is going on. And there's such a pleasure in that. This time I was so swept up in the dancing when they're at the hop and the camera's kind of at hip level. And it reminded me of some of the sequences in Northern Soul or even last year's Lover's Rock, in the way that you totally feel like you are dancing with them. And it's that energy and that kind of like the raucous kind of sexy dancing that would have made the suburban housewives just scream into their pillow because they were so afraid of what might be happening at the hall downstairs. And we're kind of right in that. I found so exciting, but who knows what I'll get out of it next time, but I'm sure I will. So yeah, I'll go for a 4 again, because I'm not sure that all viewers would be so kind of swept up in it that they'd be wanting to go back to this world in such a jiffy as I would.
Helen.
Yeah, I'm going to be quite a bit lower on this one. Probably unlikely that I'd revisit it. There'd probably need to be some kind of slightly bigger occasion for me to return back to this one. So I'm going to 1.5.
Oh, Michael, a dagger to your heart.
Sorry.
Okay, so repeat being score for this. I've seen it twice. I think the first time I didn't know what it was called. And I was just like, hold on, is that Harrison Ford and Richie Cunningham? And then you just kind of watch the film, and I always remembered it. And then for some reason, they just hadn't got around to watching it. And this is why, you know, Netflix is awesome for a film that you haven't been bothered to track down or is difficult to find. And then suddenly it's there and you're like, oh, awesome. And I referenced this when we did our Booksmart episode of this, you know, the story of One Night film, and I saw that this had just come out. So I was excited to watch it, but I don't think I'll watch it frequently. Whereas, you know, Days Confused, I'll watch once a year. This will be once. If it's on Netflix forever, I'll watch it like once every couple of years, I reckon. Yeah, maybe less than that. So I'll go for 2.5. Small screen score. Michael?
I think this is a great small screen film. I have seen it on the big screen. It is a film that a friend of mine...
Was it at a drive-thru?
Oh, no, that would be really interesting, right? I've had terrible experiences at drive-thrus. What did I see? I saw Locke at a drive-in cinema.
That's a good idea in theory.
And it was in Trafford Park in Greater Manchester, and it was a weird one because you had to sort of back in the day they'd have it was different technology now because you had to use a Bluetooth thing to beam in, and you realise that actually the sound system isn't very good in a drive-in nowadays. But I saw American Graffiti. It's a cinema that a friend rented out for their birthday, and it's a good one. But I also think it's a great small screen movie. This viewing that really made me fall in love with this film was actually like a 12:30, 12:30 screening on Film 4 years ago. And they showed it in a double bill with Dazed and Confused. And it is a film to watch alongside these other films if you wanted to do it with Fast Times at Ridgemont High as well. They do complement each other really well and are in dialogue with one another too. So I think this is a film that works really well on the small screen. Maybe on the big screen you might be able to get more of an impact from the soundtrack, but I'm going to give this a 4 for small screen.
Jake?
I haven't seen it on the big screen. I do feel like I've missed something because I think so much of what makes the film great is in the sound of it. And I would love to hear that kind of big and loud and bouncing around the room. But because it is not like instantly the most engaging thing, being able to relax onto your big sofa and kind of cuddle up with it is actually really complements the experience compared to if you're in a crap cinema with bolt upright fold out seats. I don't think would actually benefit it. So I've kind of offered two contrasting thoughts there. Let's go with a 3.
Helen.
Yeah. So, you know, when I said like I needed the event, I think the event that I need is the drive-through experience. I watched this on an iPad because I was traveling, so I didn't have much choice. And I'm pretty sure that is not the experience George Lucas would have wanted me to experience it on. I think I probably would have been a bit more engaged and a bit more sold into it if it had been kind of like a drive-through sort of immersive event where people were kind of like roller skating about and bringing me shakes and things and kind of brought me into the world a bit more.
I've always wanted to go to one of those places. Do they still exist where they just hook the burgers on the side of the car?
I don't know.
Oh, they look great. Mm. I would love that.
But I don't have a car, so this may not happen for me.
you go to America, you hire a car. This one I'm thinking, go back to 1950s. Sorry.
So yeah, I think I probably would have been a bit more engaged in it and a bit more into it had I seen it on something a bit bigger. Yeah, and just to draw me in a little bit more. And like you said about the soundtrack, having that a bit more in stereo rather than just in my earphones. So I'm going to give it a 3.5 small screen.
Yeah, I'm going to give it 3.5 as well. I think for me, I'd love to watch it at the Prince Charles, but as a marathon with like Dazed Confused, Warriors, maybe not Fast Times, but that kind of film. I think that'd be a good kind of lazy teen film marathon, apart from Warriors, which is quite high energy and frantic. I think about the films that made that marathon, but I think that kind of concept would work well for me. So 3.5 engagement score, Michael.
So I think I'm going to give it 3 out of 5 for engagement. And I don't think that's necessarily a negative thing because it does invent the sort of hangout movie formula where you can just zone in. Because that is sort of the rhythm of the film is one where you are sort of driving up and down the high street in Modesto at night and what characters are going to come round the corner next. So if you do drift away, that's almost part of the appeal of it. You're not going to miss a great twist or a foreshadowing or something if you do zone out. But I'll give it 3, but that's caveated as I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
Jake?
I think I can echo what Michael said there. I do think like you have to be on its wavelength. I think it's the kind of film where you might be able to tell 15 minutes in whether or not you're going to go with it. And if you're not kind of going with any of these characters and it's bouncing between them and this fairly sporadic structure, it's going to make it harder to latch onto any of it. But I do think it is a very exciting film and you can get kind of caught up in the thrills of it and the kind of just the heady sound and vision that comes with it. And also the fact that Richard Dreyfuss in this dresses like Richard Dreyfuss.
How old is Richard Dreyfuss in this? Because he looked very young, but at the same time, he didn't look like... I think he had kind of...
It's funny, isn't it? You can't place it.
A bit of puppy fat. That he doesn't have...
I think he's early mid-20s, so he is a good few years older than he should be, because he's a good few years older than Ron Howard.
Sure.
But he looks like he's just a bit old. He believes he's old beyond his years.
Yeah.
He's an 18-year-old who carries himself like a 25-year-old, but he happens to be a 25-year-old who's pretending to be an 18-year-old carrying him like a 25-year-old. Yeah, exactly.
Engagement score, Helen?
Yeah, I'm a 3 as well. I think there's moments of it where... It is kind of, you know, people are just sort of driving around and songs are happening. And then there's, you know, kind of bits where things are, there's a bit more action. And that's just kind of the vibe, really. So, yeah, 3.
Yeah. In terms of, straight 3s for this one. In terms of hangout films, this is one where you don't need to be paying attention, but it does pay dividends if you do. But I think I'd always put this on when I'm not really looking to focus on anything too much. It's just kind of... lazing on the sofa kind of vibe. So that gives an overall score of 3.45625.
Which is pretty decent.
Yeah, it's decent. Happy with that, Michael?
That's good. I'm happy with that. More importantly, where does that rank alongside Hard 8, Jake's first pick when he was on the Flicks Watcher in the past? Do you remember, Jake?
Oh, no. Probably. It's better. Hard 8 didn't get a great reception.
I thought it had.
Sorry.
Was it Helen and Lou that...
Yeah. That's fine. I've accepted it. You know.
Okay, I'll accept it too.
If you go to flickswatch.tv/scoreboard, you can see all of the scores. Hard 8 got 3.24250. So yeah, it's beaten it. You've beaten it.
But out of all of my appearances, what is, if I can get the live updates, if you've got it there, Kobe, what about 20th Century Women and Deep Impact?
20th Century, well, Deep Impact was 4.00000. And 20th Century Women was 4.48. That's a stellar score.
That was Louisa's pick, though, right? That wasn't your pick, Jake. You can't take credit for that.
That was Louisa.
You may have been in the room when you watched it, and that's how you got the T-shirts idea. But you can't take credit.
No, it's like the Francis Ford Coppola credit.
He was in the room. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, I saw that.
Louis the George Lucas.
But I saw that. I was like, is it though? Guys, tell us where we can find Ghibli Tech, the book and the podcast, and sign off to everyone who's listening.
Yes, please search for Ghibli Tech wherever you buy books. We're on sale right now. You can even go down to your local bookshop and see if it's on shelves there. Ghibli Tech is spelt GHIBLIOTHEQUE. And for the podcast, put Ghibli Tech into whatever podcatcher you use. We've just recently finished a great run of interviews with people who have been inspired by the work of Studio Ghibli, so filmmakers, critics, artists, including, we mentioned Sony Animation up top, Mike Rianda, the director of Mitchells vs. the Machines.
He's always great, probably Mike Rianda. Every interview I heard with him, he's super high energy and such a dude.
We interviewed him 5 p.m. on a Friday, so we were very, very drained by the long working week, and he was like a shot of quadruple espresso right in our headphones. He's fantastic talking about Ghibli. But yeah, check us out wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Twitter as well, at Ghibli Tech.
It's great having that unique name, isn't it? Someone had Flixwatch on Twitter. We later killed, but they took the password with them, so we can't use it. Thank you very much, guys. It's been amazing. Thank you for coming back on again, Jake and Michael. You know, you're welcome back anytime.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, absolute pleasure. Yeah,
thanks so much, guys. A real pleasure. Bye.
Cheers,
guys.
Bye.
Enjoyed this episode of Flixwatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixwatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at Flixwatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell them Flixwatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.